Welcome to the South Carolina Lead, a podcast that breaks down state political news for you and provides insight on legislative happenings under the Statehouse Dome in Columbia. Hello, I'm your host, Gavin Jackson, and this episode is for the week of December 10th, 2019. This week, we fire the Hunger Games cannon for Senator Kamala Harris and look back at her 2020 bid that ended a week ago. Jamie Lovegrove with the Post and Courier and Mayon Schechter with the state newspaper have covered Harris in the state since January and give us a post-mortem on the only female black candidate in the 2020 race. Also, interact with us on Twitter or Instagram at @SCLeadPod. We always want to hear from you and hear your thoughts on the episode. Every Tuesday, we give you a roundup of news, insight into the week's biggest stories, campaign trail intrigue, and a chaser of trivia. And make sure you subscribe to us on iTunes, where you can rate and review us. We're everywhere podcasts exist, including NPR One. You can listen to all four sections of the podcast instead of worrying about the upcoming French fry shortage. This is happening, people. This is real. There was a cold, wet potato harvest that therefore did not give them the yields that they expected, which means fewer French fries. Start stockpiling. Or while you wonder about that, what was it, $120,000 banana? That guy ate it? Yeah. Okay. You're going to be thinking about that a lot. I don't know what happens down in Miami. You can get like several bananas for a couple bucks. A lot going on down there. And now for our brief quorum call. Quorum call is a term to see if there's a majority present. But here on the South Carolina Lead, we know majority of the time that you're not always current with the news. So here's a quick recap of several top stories you should know about. Number one, the Post and Courier reports that despite the ongoing trade war, the state should be able to avoid a recession thanks to strong consumer spending. This according to U.S. economists Doug Woodward and Joey Von Nessen. The two released their annual Economic Outlook report that expects job creation will slow to 1.5% next year. This is down from 2%. Personal income is projected to rise by a strong 5.6% next year, about the same as 2019. Buy some bananas. Number two, the Greenville News reports that the South Carolina Attorney General Alan Wilson said that gun restrictions approved by the City of Columbia earlier this year should be repealed because they violate both state law and the Second Amendment. The City Council previously approved a red flag ordinance that would enable police to seize firearms from residents who are deemed to be extreme risks. At the same meeting, another ordinance was approved prohibiting possession of firearms within 1,000 feet of private or public schools in the city. The City Council also approved a measure in July banning homemade guns without serial numbers. Mayor Steve Benjamin called all these measures legally valid. Number three, the Greenville News reports that a woman from the upstate is the first person to die from a vaping-related illness in South Carolina. This according to the State Department of Health and Environmental Control. The victim was a woman over 65 with underlying health conditions who died the past week. There aren't too many details about this because the incident remains under investigation. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reported nearly 2,300 cases of the vaping-related illness across the nation, including 48 deaths. As of Wednesday, 35 cases had been reported in South Carolina. And number four, the Post and Courier reports that 2 days after leaders at the Medical University of South Carolina announced their new $389 million children's hospital would not open until sometime next year, state inspectors' reports show the building suffers from major issues of concern. A main issue is the exhaust system tied to the hospital's backup generator. The report also touches on other areas of concern, including structural issues with the building's louvers, which allow air to flow into the building while keeping water out. And now for our Florida Man News segment. Every week we give you a headline, just a little taste of the most captivating Florida Man news. Headline: Florida Man spits food in woman's mouth during road rage incident. Come on.
Was it the banana?
And like me having another water heater issue at home, I guess I'll just bury the lead and take cold showers forever. Is that what you want? We're going to start our discussion with a little bit of a throwback. Way back in January, even before Senator Kamala Harris announced her run for president, she briefly spoke at the Alpha Kappa Alpha Gala in Columbia before more than about 1,000 people. She said nothing groundbreaking at the time when she took the stage. It was very brief. It wasn't a political event after all. But she kept it light even in the massive media scrum that followed. It was massive, guys. Ones that we haven't seen since then, really. And it was so loud she had to crouch down so reporters could hear her. And that was the start of 2019 in South Carolina for Kamala Harris, a state she visited more than any other candidate. one with the most diverse voting electorate of the early states, but also one where polls lately had her in fourth place and usually in mid-single digits. She ended her bid last week after citing campaign financial concerns. With me to do this South Carolina autopsy on Harris's campaign are two reporters that were there on that cold night in January at the gala with me and at several stops along the way. Jamie Lovegrove with the Post and Courier and Mayan Schechter with the state newspaper are here. Hello to you both.
Hello. Good morning.
How far we have come.
I know. I mean, looking back, I was looking at that photo. I think, Mayan, you were like up top, right? Like there's like this balcony at the state fairgrounds and like you were, yes. I mean, it was just, we just haven't seen anything.
It was
like
a really long night.
And she didn't even say anything.
No.
Like, you remember? Like everyone's trying to hear what she's saying. You know, all the speculation was going on, but we didn't get much out of it. But, you know, fast forwarding to what we just heard from her last week in this campaign, this news that shook staffers, it shook everyone. No one expected this. No one saw this coming. We heard a lot of reports about, you know, things being moved around in the campaign, her staff shakeups, like a lot of stuff being aired out to dry. Mm-hmm. But again, like people didn't expect it to happen like this. But what we heard in her email to supporters and was forwarded to everyone, she said, "I'm not a billionaire. I can't fund my own campaign. And as the campaign has gone on, it's become harder and harder to raise the money we need to compete." So, Jamie, at the heart of all this, it came down to money, despite her having, you know, a lot of strong fundraising quarters that we thought were going to help propel her, at least through the early states, obviously.
Her fundraising had become a problem over the course of the year. And, you know, I think there was probably some saving of money that she could have done earlier on that she did not do and sort of expected the fundraising to keep up at the pace that it was going at the beginning of the race, which it really hasn't for any of the candidates.
Yeah.
I mean, you come out of the gate and everyone's excited and they give you all their money. And then after that, it starts to get that much harder to keep raising it. And I think that she said that where there were reports that she would have needed to raise $5 million in 2 weeks at this point to have the money she wanted to run the campaign she wanted to do. And I think that that's an important point to be said, is that it's notable that she dropped out because we've seen all these other candidates who are doing far worse still in the race.
Yeah.
And I think that does reveal a difference in the attitude and the approach that she had to this race than some of those others. She was in this to win it.
Yeah.
And she was not in this to get her name up. She was not in this for, you know, fame or excitement of the campaign trail. She was in it to win it. And when it became clear to her that she wasn't going to be able to do that, she was ready to drop out. Unlike some of these other folks, particularly folks who don't have elected office to fall back on, they have nothing to lose. They might as well stay in the race, you know. Let's see what happens in Iowa. Maybe something crazy will happen.
Yeah.
You know, for her, once she didn't have those resources to put up the ads that she had started creating, there were some really powerful ads that she had started putting up online, but she could not get the resources to put them on TV in Iowa, to put them on TV in South Carolina. So her strategy was sort of the most analogous of all the candidates to Obama 2008. They've all kind of tried to have some pieces of Obama 2008 and tried to pick that apart. But what, as we all know, what was so successful for him was that he was able to pull off this incredibly strong performance in Iowa, you know, come out on top there, didn't really compete in New Hampshire. Hillary did much better than him there, but then came down to South Carolina, beat her very comfortably here. And then once you have those two early states, you've shown that you can put a coalition together and you start to have a lot more momentum, particularly as you go into other southern states and Super Tuesday. And so she was trying to emulate that. But the key first step of that is you got to do well in Iowa.
Yeah.
And I think even though she had been doing a little better here, obviously she was not winning here, but she was doing a little better. You know, she was, if anything, falling in Iowa at this point. You know, we've seen other candidates get this surge momentum in Iowa, Pete Buttigieg, Elizabeth Warren, but she was just never able to find it. And so that put the entire strategy in significant peril.
Yeah, I mean, you did see that the bump she got over the summer when she got her dig in with Joe Biden on the debate stage. That really led to a lot, like in the really spike things. But then after her, you know, subsequent performances on the debate stage didn't really kind of keep that momentum. She didn't really have those big strong moments. She had some, but like not enough to really get that clearly defined personality in the race that you would think that she was going to bring to the race and really kind of define it. And instead, she kind of just fell into the more moderate genre of all these other candidates.
Yeah, I think, I mean, this race is really, I think, complicated because Joe Biden is in it. I think had he not been in it, we definitely would have seen candidates move in very different ways, particularly with her. I mean, she came off as a more moderate candidate compared to some of the other kind of very progressive Sanders, Warren candidates that could have helped separate her and move herself apart. And given the fact that she did have a decent sized coalition here in South Carolina, I mean, we maybe could have seen voters who are wrapping their arms around Biden go to her because they didn't see another moderate candidate maybe in the race, because they're not really gravitating as much toward even Pete Buttigieg. Mm-hmm. So Joe Biden being in the race definitely, I think, threw a wrench in for a lot of these candidates to kind of stick out.
I mean, it's been Joe Biden's territory down here since the beginning of it all. So, I mean, really, she hasn't had that ability to break through.
It has. And of course, you know, it should be noted, he had not made up his mind or whether he was going to get in the race when she entered the race at the beginning of the year. Not Cory Booker was the same way. Both of them got into the race while, you know, if we can remember back to that time, we weren't sure if Joe Biden was going to run or not yet. Yeah. We thought he was telling, you know, friends and allies were saying, oh, he's probably going to run. But he hadn't entered. I don't think he got until like April or something like that. So that did significantly shake it up.
Yeah.
One of the two sort of pre-mortems of her campaign that came out the week before she dropped out, the Washington Post, both Post and the Times sort of wrote stories about how it had all been falling apart.
Mm-hmm.
The Washington Post one by Chelsea Janes, you know, did kind of get at that, this idea that she didn't have this clear identity. People still had questions about who she was and what she stood for. It is reflective of this time in presidential politics that's quite different from campaigns of the past in that voters and pundits are looking for candidates who electrify certain segments of the base rather than generally satisfy a broader coalition in the base. And that's what she was trying to do, was she was trying to be the candidate who could kind of have it all, be the candidate who could win over some Biden voters, but also maybe, you know, compete with Elizabeth Warren for college-educated women and, you know, have all of these different pieces come together. You know, the problem is just then that you don't have sort of a core central group of backers to kind of give you that foundation to build on. She tried to sort of do it, particularly towards the end, as we saw with black women, which is a huge part of the Democratic electorate. And she really played that up and played up her own identity. But, you know, that just was maybe too little too late, or maybe just was not enough. You know, I think we hear from a lot of voters, including black women, that the identity question is not really, for a lot of them, the only thing they're looking for. You know, they
care
first and
I'm a black woman doesn't
foremost.
Mean I'm going to just vote for a black woman.
Right, again, exactly.
The constant thing we've been talking
over
about,
and over and over again. And obviously she was not making the case that simplistically, like, I'm a black woman, you got to vote for me, you're a black woman. But
it's just that monolithic that we always talk about. Like, you know, the black voter in South Carolina is not monolithic, guys.
Right.
And like, that's the constant narrative that, you know, these national reporters are also kind of also trying to understand too. It's like, yes, they are a lot of different people in this race. It's a huge, diverse field. Now it's less diverse, which is also becoming a concern because the top tier is whiter and older. And I guess Elizabeth Warren's up there, but still, other than that, it's men.
That's
so
still white and old.
Yeah.
And what was interesting to me, you know, during that week that she was here in South Carolina pitching her proposals to primarily black women, where she even filed to get on the ballot, I mean, a week before her announcement, she was combating this argument that she's not electable, that a lot of people have questions about her electability. The one thing that I really took away from her stop here was when she said that she was still introducing herself to South Carolinians. And that is a problem when you're now at this part, this juncture of the race. We're now almost 2 months away from the primary and you're still introducing yourself to voters. I mean, that is an issue, right?
Right.
So I think that she saw probably very quickly early. I mean, right when Joe Biden got in the race, she saw that there was going to be a much rockier path in South Carolina as people quickly made their moves to attach themselves to certain candidates.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Mayan, you bring up a good point because I was listening back to the interview I had with her when we were in Orangeburg, and she was, you know, I was asking her, like, you know, how are you different? How are you getting your message out there? She's like, oh, we still got plenty of time. People are still learning who I am. I'm like, well, you haven't really made too much, you know, you haven't made too many inroads in the state, mm-hmm. even though you've been coming here more than anyone else.
Right.
I mean, what does that say about the situation? That, again, you're kind of going back to the Joe Biden.
I mean, don't get me wrong. Like, there are undecided voters here in South Carolina, certainly. And I think, I don't know, I'm blanking on exactly the number, but I've seen like from 12 to 19. 15%. So don't get me wrong, like there are folks that are still trying to figure out which candidate they want.
And obviously folks who may prefer someone but could be willing to change their mind.
Right. But I think that's where that issue of electability comes in. I mean, these undecided voters are looking at less about policy.
Yeah.
They're really looking at like who is going to defeat Trump.
Which is the number one concern. Yeah.
Right.
And then they see Joe Biden for that. And he consistently wins that.
They may be wrong, but like that's they're putting their pundit hat on, and all the time you talk to folks, like that's the first thing they bring up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that that was a real problem for her. And, I, you know, I think in terms of the introducing herself issue, too, it's obviously true that in the last couple of months of the election, far more mm-hmm. voters tune into the race than they had previously.
Sure.
You know, we may not even be at that stage yet. I think that probably will be January-ish is when sort of the broader South Carolina public is going to really start paying much more attention as opposed to just the kind of political junkies.
Mm-hmm.
But as we say, she's been here, you know, 50 plus events over the course of this race, 17, 18, 19 trips. And unless you are going to have some new infusion of money, mm-hmm. which, again, go back to the fundraising issues we're talking about, and you can blitz the TV airwaves in South Carolina, not much is going to change. Like, mm-hmm. you're still going to be introducing yourself. And I think it's important to note that we are getting to this point now, going back to the Obama 2008 analogy that folks around her often like to play up, this is the stage in the race where Obama was overtaking Hillary in mm-hmm. South Carolina. She had led throughout the entire course of the race, way ahead just a few months earlier. And this, in the mid-December period, you know, the primary in 2008 was actually earlier. It was late January. But we are starting to get to that point where if you're going to overtake Biden in South Carolina, like now is when it's going to have to happen. And he's still up by 20, 30 points.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So
that margin is still
there. We're running out of time.
And again, everyone seems to be really pushing in Iowa there too. We're kind of going to wrap this up a little bit. But again, bring it back to South Carolina, Mayan. You had a story about, you talked to a lot of her supporters mm-hmm. after the news came out about her ending her bid. I want to know where that support goes. Did they give you an idea? I mean, she had some pretty big endorsements. Senator Darrell Jackson, Representative mm-hmm. Pat Hennigan, Representative J.A. Moore, Senator John Scott, locally.
Right.
You know, so I'm just wondering, did they give you any indication, or do we think that gets divided up with the Amy Klobuchars and the Pete Buttigiegs and the Joe Bidens of this campaign, or what's the future looking like for those supporters?
Yeah. Well, a couple of the names that you mentioned never called me back. So I will not, I do not know at this moment who they decided to land their support on.
I know it's early, but I'm wondering, the voters are much more important
than the elected officials.
Oh, sure, sure. Yeah. I mean, when I went to, and I'm sure, Jamie, you experienced the same, when I would go to Kamala Harris events and people would be there who I would talk to folks who were there who said that they were big Kamala supporters. And I said, well, what happens if she's not in the race?
Mm-hmm.
Joe Biden's name came up.
Mm-hmm.
I talked to one couple that I quoted in my story as sort of a wrap up when she exited the race. They were at Kamala Harris's event in Greenville just to see, kind of feel her out. But then when I really kind of dove deeper into, okay, but really, who do you want to see at the top of the ticket? This husband said, oh, I would love to see Joe Biden and then Kamala Harris as a VP.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly there have been, you know, swirls of rumor and everything for months about whether she could be a potential running mate. And I think we've seen it in that Joe Biden has said he would consider, among others, consider her. We've seen mm-hmm. now Warren say that she would be open to it. So I think certainly we're going to start seeing Kamala Harris supporters gravitate more toward obviously the top of some of the polling. I mean, they're going to be looking at who was the most like Kamala and who can do what Kamala did, which is reach out to black supporters and build a coalition of black supporters.
Yeah, I mean, it has been interesting to watch in the aftermath is the way the candidates have reacted.
Yeah.
Folks who did no favors to Kamala Harris while she was running now suddenly being like, oh, I can't believe it.
Like, Joe Biden's like,
so
she called her a top
mind.
Julian Castro blamed the media, saying there was a double standard covering her.
Right, and it has been interesting, you know, talking to some of the really devoted Kamala Harris supporters who really just do not take kindly to this new tone from a lot of these folks, from Elizabeth Warren, from Cory Booker, who, you know, are now kind of really reaching out to the Kamala Harris world when they were not much help while she was running. You know, I think Biden is going to be the natural for a lot of folks. And it's been interesting to watch some of the former Beto supporters.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Marvin Pendarvis.
Marvin Pendarvis, Boyd Brown, you know, have now endorsed Biden. It seems to be that he, if anything, at this stage is consolidating support more than he is losing it.
Mm-hmm.
I think, as you say, you know, South Carolinians like to pick a winner, both in terms of that they want to pick the person who's going to win the primary overall, like the entire race, the win the nomination. They also like to pick the winner in South Carolina.
Right.
And I think on both of those fronts, a lot of South Carolinians feel like Joe Biden is the most likely at this point. There's been reporting that Cory Booker's fundraising has really increased over the last week since she's been out, and he has made some concerted efforts to point out that he is now the only major African-American candidate in the race, actually other than Deval Patrick.
Mm-hmm. And
I haven't heard anything from Deval Patrick.
Yeah, I know. Mean,
but Cory Booker's also making outreach to those specific targeted like communities. Like,
yes.
He came in and did a sit-down with black men in Columbia.
Yes.
So he's doing...
he's going after that.
Taking the playbook a little bit.
I think Warren and Harris had a lot more voter overlap than people realized because, yes, they weren't quite ideologically on the same page, but there were a lot of college-educated women.
Sure.
College-educated white voters in general, particularly in Iowa, I think you saw this, and this was part of the problem why Kamala Harris was having a hard time breaking through, was that there was a lot of overlap with Warren, and Warren was just kind of edging her out on a lot of voters. So I think, you know, these obviously it's not going to go to one place entirely or another, but right now it does not seem to fundamentally change Biden's strength.
No.
Yeah, especially when you're looking at, you know, most recent polling, having her at 3%, Booker at 2%. I mean, like, we're
I'm not sold. I mean, I know that there's been thought that voters here could look at Iowa and see what happens there, where Biden isn't doing as well as Pete Buttigieg or Elizabeth Warren. I'm not really sold that South Carolinians really totally care about what happens. I mean, more so like those voters who are not tuning in to what's going on. I mean, I don't think they care what's going on in Iowa, but maybe I'm...
Yeah, I mean, obviously, it's gonna be the big headline after Iowa. It's not like you don't have to be paying attention to the news. It's gonna be everywhere. Mm-hmm. Everyone's gonna say, "Oh, this person won Iowa." I think the question is,
start listening and paying attention.
The question is, are you actually in a position in South Carolina at that point to capitalize?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what Obama had done. Was he had built the groundwork whereby he could use that Iowa result to launch himself, to propel himself in South Carolina. By the way, again, he was already winning in South Carolina at that point. But
a little bit different.
I don't think anyone is really in, maybe Warren, you know, she's kind of been in second place pretty consistently at this point. You know, if there was something big that came out of that. But again, like, he has a much safer distance right now than anyone else has. And I think, you know, it should be said also with the, we mentioned Kamala Harris and Cory Booker, they also built really strong campaigns here.
Yeah.
Really,
yeah.
Some of the, they got the best talent from the beginning because they entered the race quickly. They put an early emphasis in South Carolina, hired the most experienced folks here. And it just goes to show that there's only so much campaigns can do.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of the day, it comes down to the candidate and their appeal. The ground game is going to change things at the margins.
Mm-hmm.
But you need to have a winning message and a winning messenger first and foremost.
Mm-hmm. Lots to take away there. And again, we're still, 11, 10, 12 weeks away from the primary here.
Oof.
14 candidates on the ballot. So one less, obviously, with Senator Kamala Harris not being on,
14
on that ballot.
Certified.
So we will see. Stick with us. Stick with these guys. Follow them on Twitter. Read their newspapers. And, of course, listen to The Lead. Thank you, Jamie.
Yeah,
thank you, Mayon.
Thanks, Gavin.
It's that time again for some campaign trail news updates. We're looking at the latest in 2020-related movements affecting South Carolina, state campaign news, and highlights from the state's congressional delegation. The South Carolina presidential primary is February 29th. Here are the 14 people who will appear on that ballot. Michael Bennett, Joe Biden, Cory Booker, Pete Buttigieg, Julian Castro, John Delaney, Tulsi Gabbard, Amy Klobuchar, Deval Patrick, Bernie Sanders, Tom Steyer, Elizabeth Warren, Marianne Williamson, and Andrew Yang. Note that Senator Kamala Harris had previously filed to be on the ballot, but decertified it after dropping out and will not appear on the ballot. House Majority Whip Jim Clyburn told McClatchy that he wants a vote on articles of impeachment against President Donald Trump and for those charges to include obstruction of justice related to findings in the Mueller report. This is the strongest and most decisive statement yet by a member of the House Democratic leadership. And Senate Judiciary Chairman Lindsey Graham reiterated on CNN something that we all know is true, that Russia, not Ukraine, meddled in the 2016 presidential election, saying, quote, "It was the Russians. I am 1,000% confident that the hack of the DNC was by Russian operatives. No one else." The Senate Intelligence Committee investigation also reiterated the same thing our intelligence services declared years ago. In our final section, Did You Know?, we focus on one quirky function of the state, politics, or government. It's named after the parliamentary procedure that lawmakers use when speaking to each other. Did you know that South Carolina Public Radio's Russ McKinney is here with some more trivia? He is. Russ, welcome back.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
What do we have on tap here?
Well, it's almost the beginning of winter, and the shortest day of the year.
Correct.
Notice yesterday it's almost dark at 5 o'clock. Eastern Standard Time. You know, Standard Time was enacted in this country in 1883. Before then, as you can imagine, times were just really everywhere. Very little order when it came to official or standard times. So in the years just before 1883, maybe between the Civil War, end of Civil War in 1883, how were official times determined in South Carolina?
Let me check my watch.
How was the official standard time determined, and who did that?
Let me check my Casio.
A, the railroad companies. Mm-hmm. B, by a central town or clock, say in a town square or something like that. C, by the local post office. D, by community church bells.
Okay, so just really quick again, Russ.
Railroad companies, A. B, a central town or city clock, say in a town square or something like that. C, the local post office or postal officials. D, by community church bells.
Huh. Yeah, you know, but the railroads are so big. Yeah, I mean, I would say I felt really strong about the railroads. I'm gonna do railroads. Just the history of so many railroads in South Carolina.
Well, the trains did have to run on time, so the railroads are the ones who set the official standard times.
Mm-hmm.
However, that wasn't precise. Now, your answer is correct, but that wasn't precise. Because of the different railroad companies operating in the state, they all had their own official standard time. Walter Edgar points out in his history that at one point, when it was 8 o'clock in Columbia, it was 8:04 in Charleston and 8:17 in Greenville.
Oh, my cow. Oh, my gosh.
So our standard times weren't all that standard, you know. But if you think about it, the importance of the trains to the development of the state is really, really important. And in the 1900, 11 different rail lines were active in Columbia.
Wow.
Over 100 scheduled trains a day would stop in the city of Columbia.
And here we are complaining about...
a few are still stopped on Assembly Street right now.
That is true.
But that led to the development of cities like Greenville, Spartanburg, Columbia to become kind of the major cities, along with Charleston, in the state.
Yeah, Florence was a big railroad town, too.
Sure.
That's what made me think of it. So, very interesting, and I guess one of those things we just kind of take for granted. I mean, it's dinner time. And we'll see what happens with daylight saving time. Thank you, Russ. Thank you for that insight.
Sure.
The South Carolina Lead is one of many ways SCETV wants to help keep you informed. Check out the latest news and live streams on SCETV.org. Listen to coverage from South Carolina Public Radio and watch This Week in South Carolina, a show where I talk with the newsmakers of the week on SCETV, Friday at 7:30 p.m. and Sundays at 11:30 a.m. All of that, this podcast, and more is available on SCETV's Super Easy to Use app and SouthCarolinaPublicRadio.org. Subscribe to us, and we'll have a new episode for you every Tuesday on Apple Podcasts. Search us easily on your Android, Spotify, the NPR One app, wherever you find podcasts. Also, be sure to rate and review us on iTunes. Follow us on Instagram at SCLeadPod, and you can see photos from the studio, on assignment, and of course, our dank memes. We're also on Twitter with the same handle at SCLEDEPOD. We have swag, sticker swag that is. Send us a direct message on Twitter or Instagram with your address, and we'll send one your way. Email questions, comments, or your gripes to scled@scetv.org. South Carolina Lead is produced in partnership with South Carolina ETV, South Carolina Public Radio, and a special thanks to the Post and Courier and the State Newspaper. Our producer is A.T. Shire. Sean Birch is our supervising producer. Tom Posey is our executive producer. This episode was recorded and produced in South Carolina Public Radio's studios here in Columbia on December 9th, 2019. I'm Gavin Jackson. Thanks for listening.
Secret message. If you look into a mirror and say Brexit three times, Boris Johnson will appear behind you with crumpets.